Thank you for tuning in to the Essential Church Podcast, a church where we focus on restoration over denomination. If you're in the Virginia Beach area and would like to find out more about Essential Church, visit our webpage at essentialchurch.com.
Anybody seen the movie The Fisher King way back when? Anybody? Couple? Yeah, it's old movie. But one of the greatest lines, one of the greatest romantic lines of any movie ever made is that moment there when she's like, you know, this is just, you know, typical, same old thing. And he's like, no, that's not at all what this is. This is me finally getting the opportunity to be with somebody that I'm in love with. And it's just this beautiful, majestic moment. Either that or he's a complete stalker. So one of the two is really what you're thinking in that moment. The backstory, though, is he happens to be every day across the street from where she works, and he's been noticing her from afar, and is just kind of, you know, come to love everything about her, and finally has the opportunity to meet her, and so goes and shares that with her. And, you know, what she summarizes in there is basically the culture in which we live in. There's this pattern, and there's this routine that pushes us towards, and in the end, it leaves me feeling like dirt. And I don't like it, and I don't, you know, want to be a part of it, and it's just sort of depressing that that's really the best that we can hope for. And that's really kind of why we started this series 2 weeks ago, because that sort of summarizes where our culture is at. We talked 2 weeks ago about how the way we view sexuality in church is very similar to a small village down by a river that is terrorized by crocodiles, and crocodiles continually come up out of the water and bite off people's arms and legs and destroy families and take people from time to time. And nobody in the town will talk about crocodiles. We're just not going to talk about it, act like it's not an issue, not a problem. We're just going to avoid it and not really address it. And that's really the stance the church has taken ever since I can remember, or ever since I think you can go back in history. Basically, we're just not going to talk about it. However, you know, if you look at what is it that's hurting and plaguing most of the people in our church day in and day out, week in and week out, it is what happens in this area of their life, is that it just sort of spills over and affects everything. And sort of all of culture got moved in a certain direction about 50 years ago. It's what was known as the sexual revolution. Back in the 60s is when it all kicked off. And just recently, one of the beginners or founding fathers of the movement, Hugh Hefner, recently passed away. But one of his quotes from the 60s really continues to live on and summarizes the sort of ethic of the entire time. And that was, he says, listen, sex is just a function of the body, a drive which man shares with animals, like eating and drinking and sleeping. It's a physical demand that must be satisfied. Sex is here to stay, so let's just forget the prudery and that makes us hide from it. Throw away the inhibitions and just find a girl who's like-minded and let yourself go. Now, we looked a couple weeks ago from 1 Corinthians 6, and Paul says this exact thing. You've heard it said, food for the stomach, stomach for the food. That's pretty much the idea, is that, you know, it's just another biological function. And then we also looked at and said, what is the reflection of how this is taught in schools nowadays? This is a this, and that is a that, and if you do this without one of these, well, then you might get this or that, right? Which is more reflective, or which do you think has influenced the way that it is taught in schools? God's word in the context thereof, or Hugh Hefner's view on sexuality? Now, if you were to go to somebody and say, you know, Playboy's done more to affect the view of sexuality and the way it's taught in our schools in the Bible, they would have no idea what your context you're talking about. Read in this quote, though, and it reflects exactly where we are today, which leaves somebody feeling like dirt, hopeless that she'll ever find somebody who can love and accept her for who she is. And so the sexual revolution kicked off in the 1960s, and it's been said that of all the revolutions of the 20th century, the Industrial Revolution, the Technology Revolution brought us computers and the internet and everything else, the most profound effect on all of humanity and culture in America has been the sexual revolution. Mark Dever put it this way, he's a pastor up in D.C. He says, the most important revolution of the 20th century was the sexual revolution. Contraception was replaced by, had to replace conception. Pleasure was now separated completely from responsibility. It was as if a license was being handed out to anybody and everybody, legitimizing the bending of every part of our lives around serving ourselves and having our own needs met. Since that time, sexual sins have become accepted in increasing percentages of the public. Pornography is now a huge business, and it's not just a problem with society out there. Many churches have found their members plagued by marriages that are going down directions they never should have, illicit affairs, and so on. These so-called private sins have now turned into public disgraces, some of which are known and some of which are not yet known. So ever since the 1960s, We make movies about it. We are entertained by it. We sing songs about it. We sell products with it, anything from dish soap to cars. And then the result is that it leaves us with this idea that, you know, if you just, you know, want to enjoy life, you need to be pushed as far to the limit as you possibly can go. You know, as Hugh Hefner would say, just throw off all restraints and find somebody who's down with it. And you begin to ask, where is the limit? And nobody will really tell you the limit is. They pretty much just say, whatever you can get away with, that's the limit. But here's the thing. They push you and market, entertain you with that. But the second you do something and you get caught or you get found out, what happens? We label you. We arrest you. We fire you. We divorce you. We abandon you. We disown you. We publicly humiliate, disgrace you. All of Hollywood even goes, I can't believe that somebody would do something we entertain people with. Oh, your moral outrage is touching at this moment. I mean, how is it that a culture that pushes everybody in the country down this road, when one of their own goes down that road, they all of a sudden want to go, oh, we're the moral police and we can't believe this would happen. Of course it would happen. It's where we all get pushed. It's the direction everything is leading us. And so the heartbeat behind this whole series is there was a sexual revolution back in the 1960s, and the people of God desperately need a new sexual revolution, which is fueled by the revelation from God. Over in Proverbs chapter 29, it says, where there is no revelation from God, people cast off restraint. I think the King James says it, where there is no vision, the people perish. I don't think this is ever more applicable than when it comes to our sexuality. Where there is no revelation from God, we don't have a vision from God with what he designed it or intended it to be, people will literally cast off all restraint. And when somebody like Hugh Hefner comes along and says, here, look at this, do whatever you want to do, we cast off all restraint because we have no idea that this was a gift of God, created by God, to be a blessing from God. And so people just run off with all, without a care in the world and cast off all restraint. Where there's no vision of what God intended this for, the people perish. Visions perish, lives perish, marriage perish, everything connected with this perishes. The hope that this girl had of ever having a true relationship, would you say, is completely perished? I mean, here's somebody standing in front of her who genuinely loves her for who she is, and she can't even wrap her mind around that would even be possible because of the cesspool that society has led her to. Everything has just been completely destroyed. What you see in Scripture, though, is God does have a revelation for what he wants and what he's always intended this to be. We begin to see that over in Hebrews chapter 13, verse 4, where it says, marriage should be respected by all and the marriage bed kept pure. Marriage should be respected by all and the marriage bed kept pure. Now, one thing about the sexual revolution is it taught us all to not respect marriage, not to want to be married, have anything to do with marriage. As a matter of fact, people even say nowadays, the best way to ruin a good relationship is to get married. Why would I want to do that to a great thing that I've got going right now? Marriage is not respected at all. I remember about 15 years ago, talking with a guy. He had no idea I was a pastor, and I was just talking. He was a salesman. He's like, I said, how do you like your life in sales? He goes, oh, it's great. And I said, well, what do you like about it so much? He goes, dude, this is the best opportunity. I'm doing medical sales. I'm visiting doctors every time. He goes, there is no better way to meet women than doing sales. I'm like, aren't you married? He goes, yeah, but see, my district is in the next county, away, so it's all, you know, she don't know anything about it. I'm like, okay. And I was like, are there really that many single girls out there into doing this? And he's like, oh, no. And he's like, he's like, come here, I'll take you under my wing. I'll teach you how to do this, man. And I'm like, you don't really have a clue who you're talking to right now, but okay. He goes, listen, man, you want to find the married ones. I was like, why? He goes, because they don't expect any commitment, and they're okay if you don't call them later, man. They just, you know, they're in it. You know, they know what it's all about. They're down for a good time, and it's all good. You get the single ones, though, they actually want a relationship, and you don't want any of that. Oh, okay. All right, good. Thanks for the tips, man. Marriage is not respected anymore. People think that, you know, this is a basically something that says, keep away, I'm committed. To this guy, it was a homing beacon where he'd found his next prey. And so we think to ourselves, well, if I go out and I go out and have a good time or go in an environment where maybe somebody with lesser morals might fall, it doesn't matter for me because I've got the ring on. I'm not one of those sleazeballs who's going to take the ring off. What do you find? You put it on. There was even a movie. Remember Adam Sandler movie where basically he would wear the ring and it was like a big attractive thing if you just had the ring on? I don't remember the whole context of it, but it's one of those ones out there. So he says the marriage should be respected by all. That was God's vision, to be respected, that people would understand this is a commitment that you don't get a part of. It's as if basically God is saying there should be a ring. I'm not going to hula hoop. There should be a ring around you and your spouse. And the two of you are in it, and nobody else comes in. They should respect this ring. It's not just a ring on your hand. It's a ring around the two of you. It's around you and everything in here between you. Sometimes people ask me as a pastor, like, what is okay in the context of marriage? And here's the simple answer. Anything that's between the two of you that you agree on, that's just you two, is okay. Anything that you bring in from outside into it, not okay. Here's part of the problem with this. We live in such a cesspool. We swim in it like a fish in water. And we can't even tell how much it's influenced. In the next couple weeks, we're going to dabble in a little bit of how much you take from this out here, and you try to bring this in here, and then you wonder why it is there's conflict or problems because she doesn't quite mesh up with, or he doesn't quite mesh up with what it is you're thinking should happen and go on here, and you don't even realize you brought something else into this. But whatever is in this circle is what God intended and God designed. And he says, and this should be kept pure. Now, the sexual revolution redefined the word pure for us. In the Bible, it was always this great, high, lofty thing. It was a wonderful thing. It was a beautiful thing. Sexual revolution says purity basically is no fun. It limits everything you can do in your freedom, and you'll be miserable if you try to, you know, go down the road of purity. It's much more fun to be crazy and exciting and wild. The last thing on earth you want to do is be pure, because pure is boring. And God's like, no, here's the thing. If you experience purity here, and you have something that is undefiled and uninfluenced, you'll see how amazing it is. And the reason why society doesn't want you to have this pure thing over here is because they can't make any money off of that. There's no money to be made by there. They can't entertain you with that. When's the last time you saw and were entertained by a pure and righteous and holy and godly, beautiful union and marriage? It's just not very exciting to watch. It's not very interesting. When's the last time you saw a product that was all about the purity of your relationship and your marriage? No. It's basically like this. We will do everything we can to get you to go outside of this ring of purity so you mess everything up, and then we will sell you products to help you somehow find something good. We'll give you some drugs you can take. We'll give you the shape that you can get into. We'll give you products you can take to get your body in the right shape so then you can be accepted or loved or honored, whatever it may be. All these things out here, and in the end, just like that girl, it leaves you feeling like an absolute piece of dirt. Because no product can ever replace the very thing that God created, designed, intended, and wanted for you. So he begins and he says, listen, this should be honored by all, should be respected. This boundary should be respected. So other people should respect the fact that there's a boundary here. And you have a responsibility to keep this boundary here because you need to keep it pure. Other people should respect it. And the two of you should try to do everything you can and work as hard as you can to keep this pure by what you do inside and outside of your relationship. And in the context of that, what you see there is the environment and the context for intimacy. See, exclusivity is the context for intimacy. Exclusivity is the environment for intimacy. Everything in the sexual revolution says, no, run out here and find something else. Come over here and be enticed by this and bring that back in. That'll spice everything up. Now, if you read the Song of Song, which we're going to get into in a minute, they didn't need any extra spicing. They found all the spice you needed was right here inside this ring of purity. But you see, there's no money to be made in that way. And so they want to sell you something and entice you by something to bring you out. But intimacy thrives in the context of exclusivity. And intimacy, what it is when it boils down to, is basically where somebody can be known and naked and tell all and you see everything, but they are loved and accepted just the same. And you saw that with Adam and Eve. It says they were naked and they were unashamed, and Adam knew his wife Eve, and they conceived and bore a child. We talked the very first week that sex, as it was intended to be, was to be a manifestation of the intimacy and the closeness and the union and the relationship between two people. The idea here is that, you know, when two people, and we're all created for community, and intimacy is the deepest, highest level of community possible. You can have this in close friendships, but ultimately it can be experienced between a man and a woman in the context of this marriage relationship where they can be fully known. You know everything about me, and you love me and accept me just the same. And sex was meant to be sort of the physical manifestation of this close, intimate oneness, this unity that's created when this happens. And in the Song of Songs, you see how this develops and blossoms between this young couple. Now, when we go to Song of Songs, we're going to start in chapter 1 and end over in chapter 7. Now, in Song of Songs, it was believed that it was written by Solomon. And I agree it was written by Solomon. I'm not really sure, though, whether it's describing one of his relationships or a relationship that he observed. And the reason why I say that is because it's well known that Solomon ends up having like 600 wives and 300 concubines. And in this story, it's a story of this amazing, exclusive, beautiful picture of marriage. And so one theory on it is that this was the very first relationship he had, and later on in life, he just kind of went off the deep end and followed Hugh Hefner and threw off all restraints. The other picture, though, and the one that I more ascribe to because it makes more sense to me, is that perhaps what had happened is that after Solomon had made a mess of his life, and you sort of see his reflective nature as he writes Ecclesiastes, where I went and I tried all these things, and I found they were all empty, and they were all void of any hope, any meaning, any significance. Perhaps maybe what happened is that he met somebody, he had a friend who experienced what God had always intended to be. And Solomon had this longing, this yearning, and says, I wish I could go back and have that. And maybe Solomon is one of the friends that's mentioned in here, but he tells the story from the first person because he so longs and desires to share and experience this kind of a relationship. And so you see at the very beginning of it, you'll see the intimacy as it is built between the two of them. Song of Songs chapter 1, it says, pleasing is the fragrance of your perfume. This is Song of Songs chapter 1 verse 3. So she's saying this about the guy. Pleasing is the fragrance of his perfume. Now, some of you guys are like, I'm out, I'm done, sorry. He's wearing perfume, not me, not manly, I'm out. Okay, let me back up, give you a little bit of context. All of Song of Songs requires context, okay? Without context, none of these things are gonna be a good pickup line, okay? None of these things are gonna build intimacy, right? So to begin with, keep in mind, you're in the Middle East, water is scarce, people don't bathe regularly, okay? You want him putting something on, okay? So they would put on oils to sort of keep the skin from drying out, cracking, and to cover the stink. A perfect modern picture of this is if any of y'all have a middle school son who doesn't shower, but has a can of Axe and they just cover the stink up. I'm good, I don't need to shower. Oh, that shirt, you don't need to wash that, I'll just put it back on. I just spray some Axe on it. It's like as if a girl's saying, baby, I know you don't have the means to shower, but when you spray that Axe on, just like the commercial. Kinda, all right? Modern interpretation, guys, she loves it when you shower. That's what she's saying. I like the Irish Spring. I like the Suave Fresh. Whatever it is you bathe with, that's cool. I like a man who smells good, and I love the way you smell when you come out of the shower. And then she says after that, your name is like a perfume poured out. No wonder all the girls love you. Okay. What you'll see throughout the book of Song of Songs is the compliments are poetically mingled between a physical comment, compliment, and a character compliment. You see, we know how to say, dang, you look good. But we're not always so good at the character compliments. And that's really something we need to cultivate. Like when I tell couples, I say, you know, you need to tell them about something that you love about them. And they usually begin with all the physical attributes, right? And then say, well, tell me something beyond the physical that you like about him. I don't know. Not good. Not romantic. If all you ever compliment them on is their physical features, they begin to wonder, do you really like me? Or do you just like the way that I look? And so she says, I love the way that you smell, but you know, your name is just as beautiful as a perfume. You're not just your reputation, but your character, the kind of person that you are. No wonder everybody likes you. No wonder you're so popular. No wonder, you know, any girl would die to be with a guy like you. You know, it's funny, you know, sometimes what you'll see is a guy will be out and he'll be helping a friend out, and sometimes you'll see the wife will get frustrated or vice versa. You know, the wife will be over helping somebody else out and the guy will get frustrated that, you know, oh, where's she? Oh, she's not home. I wish her had dinner. It's like, you just stop for a minute and just think about the kind of kind-hearted person that you're married to that would take time out of their day to go be there. Like some of you right now might be sitting alone because your spouse is over-serving right now. And it should just endear your heart to say, you know, I'm married to the kind of person who would give of their time just to serve somebody. I mean, what an awesome thing to be married to somebody like that. She says, no wonder. One of the scenes I cut out of that movie, just for time's sake, because that clip was already a little long, is Robin Williams gets set up on this date with this girl that he's just absolutely in love with by this other guy. And they went on a double date. And so you saw kind of the beginning of the double date, and then you saw the very end of the double date after they'd left. And he does all this to try to build this guy up and, you know, convince him, no, you can do this. And so he sets them up. And after the date's over, the scene I cut out of there was of this other couple. She looks at him and she says, what you did tonight was a really good thing. And it's what I love about you. It's what I love about you. And it's this picture here of what she's saying is, your name is a good perfume. You know, the kind of reputation you have because of the character of who you are smells better to me than even the way you smell with that perfume you're putting on. And then she goes into her insecurities in verse 6. She says, don't stare at me because I'm dark, because I'm darkened by the sun. My mother's sons were angry with me, and they made me take care of vineyards, my own vineyard I had to neglect. Now, interesting thing here is that everybody's standards of beauty around the world are different, okay? And we all think that everybody buys into Hollywood beauty. No, they don't. In some cultures, being thin is in. In some cultures, not being thin is in. Like, for instance, when Rebecca was in Ghana, they did not want a skinny girl, period. Because if you were skinny, it probably meant that you were malnourished, meant that you might have disease, and so it was a stay away. You found a girl who had some meat on her bones, you're like, there's a good-looking mama. And so they would want to be bigger. And see, some of you all laugh at this. Some of you are thinking, Ghana, where is this place? Where? No. And that's the problem with standards of beauty, is that you get bought into the idea of beauty, but you don't realize that beauty is all man-made. Beauty is all a cultural thing. It's a cesspool that you're living in that tells you this is what you have to look like in order to be loved. But then you can go somewhere else and people will be like, ew, no, not for me. Now, skin color is an interesting thing. You see, among white Americans, everybody wants to be tan. You know, the tanner you are, women will go and fry themselves under a light. Men and women will go and spray paint their body a darker color, okay? All to make them more attractive. In other cultures, light-skinned is preferred. If anybody ever seen the documentary Meet the Patels on Netflix? Anybody? Nobody? You guys are missing out on good stuff. One? You've seen it? Okay, it's hilarious. In Indian culture, lighter skin is preferred. And so the mother is calling him up, and he's over in America, and he's been hanging out at the beach with friends, and she's like, Ravi, your marriage value is plummeting every time you go out in the sun. It's a sort of hilarious moment because he's getting too dark. And she's like, how will I ever find a woman for you with as dark as you're getting? And so this is what she's saying, that, you know, I had a hard life growing up, and I couldn't stay inside, because back in their culture, if you were lighter skin, it mean you didn't have to be out in the sun working, and so it was a sign of affluence. And so she's basically saying, you know, I had to go out and work the fields with my brothers. They wouldn't let me stay inside. They didn't honor me and value me and cherish me as a girl. They just threw me out there with the other boys. And they basically said, if we got to be out here working, sister, you're out here working with us. And so she had to work out there, and so her body reflects it. And so many of us have areas of insecurity because of our past or what we've been down or a medical condition or something we've been through. And so we wonder, can I be loved with as I am now? And so for her, it's dark skin. She's saying, can you love me for the condition my skin is in? Because they would be covered up. And so she's like, I'm afraid to reveal to you just, you know, what the sun has done to my skin. And he says back to her the most loving thing. He says, I liken you, my darling, to a mare among all of Pharaoh's chariot horses. You're thinking, did he just call her a horse? Once I said, you got to get the context. I would not recommend taking these lines verbatim and seeing how far they get you, because they're not. You got to go with the meaning behind it. He's bringing up something she would know. In Pharaoh's army, there'd be hundreds, if not thousands, of chariots full of all different kinds of horses. However, the horses that would drive the Pharaoh's chariots were these brilliant, white, flawless, perfect mares. And you could tell from a distance in the army battlefield, as you looked out and you'd see all these chariots lined up, you could pick out Pharaoh's chariot from a mile away. Why? Because you would see that right there is the fairest of them all. And what he's saying, baby, when I look at you, I see the fairest, most perfection. You know, you're like the horse that stands out among 10,000. You know, your skin tone to me is absolutely radiant, beautiful enough that it would be the choice one that the king would choose to put before him. That's what I see when I see you. And so she begins to share and open up with her insecurity, and he meets it with how it is that I see you in that insecurity. It's what I love about you. It's what makes you, you. Everybody else may see this as an idiosyncrasy, but me, I see it as something very unique. And, you know, all the things he says in there about her, it's just he says, all those things that, you know, you may not like about yourself, it's what I love about you. It's what I love about you and who you are. Now, they continue on back and forth, these different compliments. She compliments him, he compliments her. And then you get to chapter 4, and they get married, and there's this amazing honeymoon night. If you really want to see how PG-13, if not rated R, the Bible really is, you can go there. We're going to dabble over into chapter 7, though. In chapter 7, they've been married a while. And what's unique about chapter 7 is something I've observed. Having been married, have a wife pass away, go back and live in Singletown for a while, and then now I live back in Maryville, if you know what that means. See, Singletown's this place you go after you either get divorced or you lose your spouse, and you move back into this new development called Singletown. And in Singletown, everybody works out, okay, because you got a lot more free time on your hand. Even if you don't, you still got to work out because you got to look good. Women, they wear a lot more makeup. They do their hair everywhere they go. They're always looking their best. Guys are always, caring about their physique and their form and how they look and how they present themselves, making sure they look good. They smell good every time they go out. It doesn't matter if you're going to watch a football game, you're looking the best because you never know when the one might show up, right? So Singletown is just what you do. And Rebecca and I would sit on chairs at soccer games, and we would look around the place, and we could tell who lived in Maryville and who lived in Singleton. And if you've watched me on stage over the past couple years, you can probably tell when I lived in Singleton and when I was back in Maryville. So my pant sizes adjust with each of those things because none of us are immune to it. One of the things I realized, though, moving from Maryville to Singleton and then now back to Maryville, is the way that you date in Singletown is very different than the way that you date in Maryville. And if you try to date in Singleton the way that you date in Maryville, you will never have a second date, if not even a first date. Because a Maryville date looks like this. Oh, hey, are we doing anything Friday? Do we have anything going on? We have an open Friday? The kids aren't doing anything? I don't have to be aware? Your mother's not coming over? My dad, we're all good? Let's go out, just you and me. And she's like, wow, great, let's do that. For as far as the guy's concerned, that's the only thing he plans, right? Except for he makes arrangements. He's like, I'm going to get off early Friday. And so she's thinking, this is amazing, wonderful, you'll be home early. Not to help or do anything, just so I can get ready. So I get home, I leave work, I'll make sure I can get off work at 4. I come home, get all ready, get all dressed, be looking at the nines and ready to go out the door at 6 o'clock. And I get in the car and I look over and I say, hey, babe, where you want to go? Because ain't no mountain high, ain't no valley low. Ain't no dollar amount too expensive. Wherever you want to go, I'll take you. You say the word, I will take your chariot there. And she says back, I don't know, where do you want to go? Now, as a married guy, I'd be like, she can't make up her mind. What she's really saying is, in a very polite and subtle way, you haven't planned anything. You haven't thought anything beyond just, let's go out, that's it? Now, here's what I found out in Singleton. To go out on a Friday night, you have to find a sitter who's available, and sometimes it'll take you 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 calls down to the high school kid you're thinking, I don't really know if I trust them with my kids or not, but, I guess if it's important enough, we can go and do this. I'm not really sure. I got to get a few references on this. I'm really kind of nervous because I don't know. So you finally find somebody who's available at the right time. You get that worked out. Since you haven't been told where you're going, you have no idea what to wear or what to prepare, but you're thinking, okay, I'll lay a few things out just so that way I can be flexible with whatever. Maybe it's going to be a surprise. I don't know. And then you get in the car and you find out he doesn't know where you're going, so you show up somewhere and there's like an hour wait. You know what I found out in Singletown? You can actually make reservations at places. Did you know that? All you married people may not know this, and the coolest thing in the world is when you walk into a joint and the girl you're with is like, oh my gosh, all these people here, what are we going to do? Just wait here a second. Swisher, party of two. Oh, yes, Mr. Swisher, I'll have your table for you just a moment. I made reservations. What? Yeah, baby. Maryville's never heard of that, okay? Now, let me just let you know. If you're online dating and you're in Singletown, okay, and you take the same philosophy, and you're trading back chats, texts, Bumbles, whatever it is y'all people do, right? And you write, hey, you want to go out sometime? Love to. When? How about Friday? Sounds great. Oh, by the way, can you get me a sitter for the kids? And I'll go wherever you want to go. Swipe left. If you know what that means. She ain't writing back, okay? She ain't writing back. Now, when you turn to Song of Song, that's why chapter 7 is so important. because they've been married a while now. And you'll see that the romance and the passion is as live then as it was when they first met. You'll see some of the same things come out now that were there way back when. This guy is not content to date in Maryville. He's going to date like he's still living in Singleton. Yet, it's all within the ring. And he's not going anywhere else. It's just right here. And he's going to date like a Singleton guy who's living in Maryville. Because that's how you continue and keep the romance alive. And so he says to her in chapter 7, verse 1, he says, "Oh, how beautiful are your sandaled feet." 3,000 years ago, complimenting her shoes still worked. There's some modern movie, and I couldn't find it, where the guy's going out on like a first date for a long time. He's like, "What do I do?" And the little kid says to him, "Just compliment on her shoes." What movie is that? Anybody know? Oh, for life of me, I can't remember what it was. I don't know if it was like Milk Money or if it was like one of the Steve Carell movies. I can't remember what it was. Anyways, moving on. He says, "How beautiful are your sandaled feet?" And he says, "Oh, prince's daughter." What's he calling her? A princess. "You're my princess. You're not a commoner. You're not just an everyday girl. To me, you're of nobility. You're set apart. You're special. There's something different about you. You are a princess to me." Then he goes on, he says, "Your navel is a round goblet." That might work today. "That never lacks blended wine. Your waist is a round mound of wheat." Probably not one you want to use. "Encircled by the lilies." All right. Let me give you some context here. There were two main harvest times for them, celebrated by the Feast of Tabernacles and the Feast of Pentecost. One was for a fruit harvest, or associated with the wine. One was for a grain harvest, often associated with the wheat. And they would celebrate these as God's provision, which is being poured out upon them. And so he's looking at her and he says, "You know, your body and you and my life are like the blessing and the provision of God that is poured over me abundantly." He says, "You know, it is a cup full, and it is a round mound of wheat. It is a full and overflowing, abundant harvest that God is giving me in you. You are a blessing that is worthy of praise to God, just like that of the feasts of our nation." Isn't that a nice compliment? You are a conduit of God's blessing. You are like the great blessing that God has poured out upon the land, and he has poured that out just for me. And I'm so impressed by it. And then he says, "Your breasts are like two fawns, like the twin fawns of the gazelle." And looking at time, I think we need to stop there before we get any further. So let's just pray. Some of you guys are like, whoa. We got time. All right. Let me give you a couple things. I got a little bit more time here. By the way, the third service should always be the best because I don't have a time limit, so you can actually hear a little bit more of this. And there's actually some really good stuff here, so I'm going to kind of run through it real quick. So he's comparing them to two furry little woodland creatures. Why? The rednecks in the room are thinking, because it's hunting season, right? The reality, though, is picture more like a, gosh, I don't even know how to say it, like, Picture more like where you would see two little baby deer, like at a zoo, a petting zoo, if you will, just to be a little more graphic. Now, here's why this is important. Here's why I went that way. You're like, "Oh my gosh, I can't believe he's talking about this in church." All right. Here's what's unique and special about this that you have to know. If you go back over to chapter 4 on the wedding night, he says the exact same thing to her. So here it is years later, and he's saying basically, "I'm still captivated by you, and I long to caress and touch you in a sensitive and tender way." Like, how would you pet a baby deer? "Hey there, how are you?" It's not a hard grope of violence. It is tender and it is soft. Okay, that's the picture here. Now, if you go over to Proverbs, he says, "Delight in the wife of your youth." Now, in our cesspool culture of the sexual revolution, where we keep going outside of this, many people who are more than a year into a marriage, or 4 years, 5 years, 10 years, have no concept of being so enamored and captivated by the one that they've been married to for this long of a time, that they're so exclusively focused inside this circle of purity that they would even have an enamoring about it. People often say, "Well, don't you just get bored inside of the same old marriage?" Well, two things. Number one is, first of all, you've never experienced the intimacy of the purity of this right here. Because you keep going all the way out here looking for other visions of beauty, you no longer realize what this amazing gift is that God's placed before you. The second thing I would say is, if you think my wife is going to be the same woman day in and day out, you've never been married. She's somebody new every morning. what she likes, what she doesn't like, what she thinks, how she's feeling, what mood she's in. Totally different girl every single day of the week, right? Why? It keeps you on your toes. If she was the same old, the very thing that drives you crazy. But if she was the same old, you'd get bored. And here this guy is many years later, and he's saying the same thing to her now as he said on the wedding night. You see how beautiful that is? Then he goes on and he says things like, your neck is like an ivory tower, which is just overly abundantly, indulgently, you know, who would, you know, coat a watchtower in ivory? I mean, think how expensive that would be. Just picture, you know, basically like you're wearing a pearl necklace because your neck is so beautiful and radiant, and it's kind of a place of you know, where beauty is usually extravagant around the neck. And then he goes on, and this is another one that needs a little bit of interpretation. Your nose is like the Tower of Lebanon. Some of you are thinking, well, I guess maybe his big nose is kind of big in that culture. What is it? Well, the Tower of Lebanon would face in the direction of Damascus is where enemies would come in to invade. And so what she's basically saying is that your nose is focused on any kind of outside influence coming in, any enemy that would come in and attack our circle of purity. You're always on the lookout for something that would invade our circle of purity. And when you're out there in the world, out there at your job, out there with your friends, I know you're always looking out for that creep who's trying to come into our circle. And he says, that's what I love about you, because I have a sense of calm and peace about the fact that I know that you're always on the lookout for one of those bums who's coming into your office place trying to sell stuff, looking for women who are married, just so we can hook up and have a good time and leave you feeling like dirt. And you're on the lookout for that, and you're not going to get suckered for that, because you got your nose looking to sniff them out. And you can smell a creep from a mile away, and I love that about you. He ain't saying, hey there, big nose. That's no. Your head are like crowns, your hair is like a royal tapestry. This king is held captive by its tresses. Every woman longs to be captivating. Sherry Eldridge wrote a great book called Captivating. We actually did it as a topic of our men's retreat a couple years back. I took some flack for it from the guys, but they came around once we, you know, got into it. And what I basically told the guys this is, listen, there is a reason why your wife will interrupt you right in the middle of your football game. Because she wants to know, what's more captivating, the Steelers, the Redskins, or me? Little side note, you can TiVo the game. You can't TiVo her. Don't even try. I'll tell you this, having lost a wife, you can't get those moments back. You can't. You can always go back and watch a game. And you know, I don't have any regrets for games I missed. I don't. I don't go back and go, oh yeah, if only I had seen, you know, the championship back in 84. But you'll regret those times when you made your wife feel like she wasn't important. He says, you're captivating to me. You captivate me. You walk in the room and I stop and I look, and you always pull my breath away. In that book, it talked about that's why little girls love to twirl. It's innate in the side of a little girl. My daughter, she can't even add 2 + 2, but she'll put on a dress and go, Daddy, look. Look at me, Daddy. Daddy, Daddy. And she wants me to stop what I'm doing and say, sweetheart, you're beautiful. What does your wife want? You to stop and not just say you're beautiful, but what do you want me to do? And then he says, how beautiful are your delights, you're pleasing, blah, 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 let's have sex. You can read it for yourself. I gave you the less graphic version. And she says back, she says, I belong to my beloved, and his desire is for me. She looks and says, you know, I can tell there is a purity about you, and your only focus is on me. And I delight in the fact that I am your only outlet and your only source for this pleasure and this delight. You're not looking out over here and then coming back in. You're not dragging ideas from here and bringing it in. Your sole focus is on me. And I consider it an honor and a privilege to be God's conduit of blessing to fulfill this opportunity and this need and this place of blessing in your life. Your desire is for me, and we're inside this circle, and I glory and delight and being the object of your desire. Then she says, let's go away. Let's go out into the countryside. Here she goes. She gets carried away. Take me away. Let's go to our hotel and then Shenandoah. Let's go out to the Outer Banks. Some of you are like, but that's going to cost money. Romance costs money, takes time, because it shows the other person that they're valuable and important. It does. And it's worth it. It's so much more worth it than a bass boat. It just is. Why did it get so silent there? So your assignment this week is to give two compliments every day this week until we meet again. Okay, so if you miss church next week, then you got to keep doing it until you get back here. So two compliments every day, one about physical appearance and one about character. Brownie points if you can mingle them in together, like they're intertwined like they do in the Song of Songs. So two compliments, one on their appearance and one on their character. And then the second thing is you have to do it both orally and in some sort of written communication. So speak it to them, either on the phone or in person, and then some written form, whether it be text, email, a note on the car, lipstick on the mirror, whatever, you know. See? Get creative here, whatever you want, you know. Nothing's out of bounds. In the circle, right? And to begin to flame again this fire of romance between the two of you. The exclusivity, the beauty, the bond, the intimacy. It's what God's desire and dream was that you experience. Let's pray. Father, so many of us are so far from this. For some, there are walls that are built up in this room right now that every compliment that's given them this week will be dismissed. Just like the girl in the movie who just couldn't even fathom. And Father, I just ask that beginning today that you might begin to knock down those walls, to rebuild intimacy, to rebuild a purity, to rebuild the kind of sanctuary, Father, that you always intended and hoped and longed that we'd be able to experience. So Father, each one of us, we come before you not to confess our partner's sins, but to confess our own. And begin by saying, God, here is how I've failed. Please forgive me because of what Jesus Christ did on the cross. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
Thank you for listening to the Essential Church Podcast. Let me encourage you to pause for a moment and reflect on what you've heard. It's not the hearing of the word, but the application that makes all the difference.